reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, June 15, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. We'll start on the first page. This headline reads, CR School Board delays vote on police in schools. School District wants to reduce disparity in arrests, by Grace King. The Cedar Rapids School Board has delayed voting on an agreement for school resource officers, police in schools, with some board members saying data on the program is incomplete. In a 6-1 vote, with President David Tominski opposing, the school board on Monday agreed to meet in a work session to further discuss the school resource officer contract before voting on it at its next meeting on July 11th. To put this program in a state of uncertainty is a little concerning for me, Tominski said. While the number of high school students charged with crimes decreased 84% during the 2021-22 school year, the number of black students being charged remains disproportionate. Black students in Cedar Rapids middle schools are almost 7 times more likely to be charged with a crime than their white peers, said Barb Hansen, the district's culture and climate transformation specialist. Black students in Cedar Rapids high schools are 2.5 times more likely to be charged with a crime than their white peers, a decrease from 4 times more likely a year ago, Hansen said. 18% of the Cedar Rapids student body is black. Superintendent Noreen Bush said there is a sense of urgency to vote on the school resource officer contract and prepare for the 2022-23 school year. I think the entities that worked closest with this information felt confident in the recommendation coming forward tonight, Bush told the board. This is the reason we have the board, is to ask the critical questions. A survey about the program sent to high school students, staff, and families received 527 responses, an 11% response rate. Respondents included 11% of high school students, 27% of high school staff, and 3% of families. None of the staff at Jefferson High School responded to the survey. Justin Bleets, the district's secondary director of culture and climate transformation, said he did not know why. Bleets said the initial survey sent to students erred in not including questions about school resource officers. Questions about school resource officers then were sent to high school students who were given time to complete the survey the last week of school. Seniors already had graduated at that time, Bleets said. School board member Cindy Garlock said the data presented to the board Monday night paints a very incomplete picture. I don't feel like I have sufficient data right now locally to make a really informed, sound decision, Garlock said, citing the low response rates on the district survey about school resource officers. I've experienced what it's like to be in the building with a school resource officer, said school board member Marcy Roundtree, who was a community engagement advocate at Washington High School before being elected to the school board in 2021. It is a very important piece of the safety of our students and staff. Roundtree advocated for more resources in the community and people who look like the students that look like me to intervene in neighborhood disputes before they get to the schools, she said. Board member Jennifer Newman said she supports keeping the proposed contract as it is. We're just not living in a world right now where it's a good time to back off from that, she said. Less than 2 hours before the school board meeting Monday, Cedar Rapids Police Department officials emailed school board members advocating for school resource officers to be added at McKinley STEAM Academy and Wilson Middle School. The letter, signed by Deputy Chief Thomas Yonker and Lieutenant Corey McGarvey, said data indicates a higher level of incidents at those schools. We envision the officers would start most days at these schools, then move to address other needs at all middle schools, according to the email obtained by the Gazette. A school resource officer would visit each middle school nearly every day. According to the data, McKinley had 16 incidents, Wilson had 14, Franklin Middle School had 8, Harding had 7, and Taft and Roosevelt had 4 each. We feel like our data doesn't show a need for a floater school resource officer, Deputy Superintendent Nicole Kuliker said Monday night. During the 2021-22 academic year, school resource officers were called to 33 incidents at Cedar Rapids Elementary and Middle Schools. Full-time school resource officers were removed from McKinley and Roosevelt before the 2021-22 school year, and full-time school resource officers were not placed at any other Cedar Rapids middle school. In June 2021, Kuliker said there was no specific reason officers initially were added to district schools, and there is no good answer about why they were later added to only 2 of the middle schools. Last year, the district and the Cedar Rapids Police set joint goals of reducing by 50% or more the number of student arrests and charges filed and of reducing the disproportionate arrest of black students by 50% or more. Concerns about the school resource officer program were brought to district officials in fall 2020 by students at Kennedy High School. Since then, students such as Wilsey Colley, who spoke during the school board meeting Monday, have continued to advocate for the removal of the school officers. Colley, who graduated from Kennedy High in May, said removing officers from middle schools is progress. Chanel Thomas, an equity coach with the district, said, "We have found ourselves at a crossroad where the institution of policing meets the institution of education. Neither system has owned or resisted the role it has played in the creation of the school-to-prison pipeline." Tamara Marcus, a social justice and climate action advocate and graduate of Kennedy High, asked the school board to take the time to get good data and make a good decision. "I don't think this is a reflection on anyone in particular," Marcus said. "It's an honest mistake. Students will be returning to the district in the fall, a great opportunity to survey the students again and get good data to make a decision." The new contract between the district and the police department, which would run until June 30, 2023, proposes to remove two floater officers and have five officers in school buildings, Jefferson, Kennedy, Washington, and Metro High Schools, and Polk Alternative Education Center, 1500 B Avenue Northeast. If floater school resource officers are retained, they could be based at the police department instead of in school buildings, and their title changed to responders, according to board documents. School officers would be required to wear soft uniforms, a polo shirt with a police logo, and khaki pants, and would still be armed. Continuing with front page news, CR Council backs police in middle high schools. School city differ on need for middle school officers, by Marissa Payne. While the Cedar Rapids School Board has delayed its vote on having police officers in the schools, the City Council on Tuesday unanimously backed the program, fearing it's a matter of when, not if, an incident will occur that jeopardizes the safety of Cedar Rapids school children. The agreement endorsed by the council calls for seven resource officers in the schools, including two stationed at middle schools. Council members authorized the city manager to negotiate a new agreement with the school district, maintaining a police presence in the schools given the number of police calls to the schools and the May shooting in Uvalde, Texas, that killed 19 students and two teachers. The council decision came a day after the school board, in a 6-1 vote, delayed a decision on the school resource officer agreement, saying they wanted more discussion and data. The agreement advanced by the 9-member city council would keep officers permanently stationed in McKinley Steam Academy and Wilson Middle School, where police responded to a higher number of incidents this past school year. "We must be a city that says we will do everything in our power that we know works to prevent these bad people from being successful," said Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell, whose children and husband graduated from Cedar Rapids schools. "There is no margin of error for us. These are our kids. If we were ever going to be accused of overprotecting, overspending, wouldn't we do it for our kids?" Cedar Rapids police and school officials agree with assigning five officers to Kennedy, Jefferson, Washington, and Metro High Schools and to Polk Alternative, but middle schools has been a point of contention. Police are advocating for the return of officers to McKinley and Wilson Middle Schools with the ability to move to other middle schools if needed. The current agreement removed officers from McKinley and Roosevelt this past year, and the two officers were on call to all Cedar Rapids elementary and middle schools. School Board President David Tominski said Tuesday after the council meeting that the city and school district both see school safety as a top priority. "Getting all the parties that are involved in this to the same table to have this discussion of the best way to prioritize school safety is what we should be doing." Councilmember Tyler Olson on Tuesday highlighted police department data showing there were 70 police calls for service at McKinley during the 2021-22 school year without an officer stationed at the middle schools, up from 16 in 2018-19, the last fully in-person year with an officer stationed at the school. About 13 middle school students were arrested during the 2021-22 school year, 9 black students and 4 white students, a decrease from about 25 students arrested during 2018-19. McGarvey said the arrests were for assault weapons, including discovery of a loaded gun, and school threats and harassment, significant issues that go beyond pushing and shoving in the hallways. "When I look at those numbers, I really think the need jumps out there," Olson said. "Putting officers back in middle schools would provide some extra service where I think we could have some schools that benefit and a learning environment that could benefit," Olson said. Council member Dale Todd said people on the front lines in the schools such as school board member Marcy Roundtree, who was a community engagement advocate at Washington High School before joining the school board last year, often support school resource officers. Flare-ups that start in a cafeteria play out in city streets and vice versa, Todd said. Keeping police officers in schools is common sense, he added, and just one piece of the city's overall strategy to reduce gun violence. Those SROs know who these kids are in the school, Todd said. They know the dynamics of what's playing out in that family or that extended family. When an event happens, I want to have somebody in that cafeteria or in that gym who knows who's who and who belongs there. It's not if, folks, Councilmember Ann Poe said. It's a matter of when. We need those 7 officers on both sides of our Cedar River. We cannot lose one more child, not one more. They're not expendable. Continuing with news from today's front page, this headline reads, Housing First in Iowa City. Shelter House opens new 36-unit building to homeless, by Isabella Zaluska. Shelter House in Iowa City has opened a second building offering permanent supportive housing for individuals experiencing chronic homelessness. The 3-story building at 501 Southgate Avenue, adjacent to Shelter House, has been lauded as a transformational Housing First effort that will save lives by providing no-barrier housing for 36 men and women. The work we do within these walls is based on the understanding that safe, affordable housing is essential to health, said Chrissy Canyonelli, executive director of Shelter House. For the men and women to be housed here, I'll go one step further and say that it is a precursor to health. Shelter House broke ground on the building with 36 one-bedroom units last June. A year later, elected officials, community partners, and stakeholders were invited to an opening ceremony before residents begin to move in later this week. 501 Southgate is the second Housing First project for the organization. The first, Cross Park Place, opened in 2019 at 820 Cross Park Avenue, south of Highway 6. Housing First is an approach that first provides stable housing for those experiencing chronic homelessness and then addresses behavioral, mental health, or addiction issues. Shelter House will provide on-site case management at 501 Southgate for residents and an exam room for partnering physical and behavioral health practitioners. Participation in services is voluntary. Debbie Durham, director of the Iowa Economic Development Authority and Iowa Finance Authority, said the opening of Cross Park Place in 2019 was her first official event as director of the Finance Authority. She said she walked out a believer in Housing First. This work not only sets the gold standard for serving the chronically homeless in Iowa, but I also know that it will soon serve as a national example of Housing First done well, Durham said, during Tuesday's opening of 501 Southgate. 501 Southgate is another example centered on innovation, she said. This project will not only allow Iowans to be served more efficiently, it really truly will save lives, Durham said. The Iowa Finance Authority awarded $2.7 million to the project, which is the same amount it contributed for construction of Cross Park Place. The Johnson County Housing Trust Fund awarded $1.04 million. The building's first residents are expected to move in later this week, and the building will be at full occupancy by mid-July, Canyonelli said. Residents will pay 30% of their income for rent and can live at 501 Southgate without expectations beyond that of a typical lease. The 36 residents moving into 501 Southgate were first engaged through street outreach. Bryson Myers, a Shelter House's street outreach and engagement specialist, goes into the community and builds relationships with individuals experiencing homelessness. We've been working with them, engaged with them through outreach for over a year and a half at this point in time. So that's how we're able to really get this program up and running, Myers said. That's why we're able to move people in the building from day one. Myers will be the supportive housing program manager at 501 Southgate. The building follows a trauma-informed design and creates a feeling of home, Canyonelli said. Trauma-informed design includes lots of natural light, tall ceilings, and monotone colors, Myers said. The intention is to maintain a physically calm environment, Myers said. Together, we are ending homelessness one person and one family at a time, Canyonelli said. Together, we are changing lives. Together, we are building community. And the last item on today's front page is headlined, State School Safety Bureau gets boost from $100 million infusion of federal funds. Funding will provide resources to school districts for gun violence safety and prevention measures, by Aaron Murphy. School districts in Iowa will have access to more resources designed to help prevent school violence, thanks to $100 million in federal pandemic relief funding that Governor Kim Reynolds is putting into the State School Safety Bureau. Reynolds announced the move Tuesday during a news conference at the state public safety offices near the Iowa Capitol complex. The resources will include state personnel, training, and emergency communication systems, all designed to help schools prevent school violence or react to emergency events like school shootings. The dedication of federal funding to the state school safety bureau comes in the wake of multiple new mass shootings across the U.S. in elementary schools, churches, and other public spaces. Every family should be able to confidently send their children to school, knowing that they will be safe, Reynolds said during the news conference. And as the governor of Iowa and a grandmother of school-aged children, I want to assure parents that your children's safety at school is just as important to me. Reynolds said more than $80 million of the federal funding will go toward conducting vulnerability assessments at school buildings and creating grants for districts to make any recommended physical changes or upgrades. Iowa Department of Public Safety Commissioner Stephen Byans said the goal of the School Safety Bureau is prevention. One of the new bureau positions made possible by the federal funding will monitor threats being made through digital sources. The goal is to identify concerning behaviors early so parents, school officials, mental health professionals, and others can begin providing assistance with and without the need for having formal law enforcement intervention, Byans said at a news conference. The Bureau also will make emergency radio systems available to any school that wants one and will create a program through which individuals can anonymously report to the Bureau via phone, website, or mobile app concerning behavior. Byans said the Bureau's resources will be created to supplement any efforts already underway at Iowa school districts and not duplicate or supplant those efforts. I wish we could say this is all unnecessary, but we cannot simply rely on the optimistic thought that it will never happen here in Iowa, Byans said. Rather, reality mandates that we roll up our sleeves and we tackle this issue head on. We owe it to our kids. We owe it to our teachers. We owe it to our communities. And we will do everything in our power to put action behind the prayer that it'll never happen here. Reynolds created the School Safety Bureau in January 2020, but the Republican-majority Iowa legislature has not funded the Bureau in the three legislative sessions since. Reynolds said on Tuesday announced she will use funding from two federal pandemic relief packages, one each passed under former President Donald Trump and current President Joe Biden. Reynolds said the School Safety Bureau was established despite the lack of state funding and that state government officials from various state agencies have been working to make the Bureau as useful as possible. The lack of state funding hasn't stopped us from doing some stuff, Reynolds said Tuesday. We didn't get the funding, so we haven't stood it up in a manner that it needed to be stood up. But now we will be able to, which I think is a wonderful use of some of the funds that are coming into the state. Reynolds said the $100 million infusion of federal funding will sustain the School Safety Bureau through 2026 and could be funded even longer pending new gun control, school safety, and mental health care legislation being considered in Congress. Reynolds said in the meantime she will work with state legislators to ensure the Bureau is funded long-term. She said once the federal funding is exhausted, her office estimates that it will cost $1.5 million annually to operate the Bureau. Now moving to local and regional news inside the paper. DeGere fighting to win common ground in Iowa governor's race. At a campaign stop in CR, challenger gives Reynolds failing grades. By Tom Barton. Despite political headwinds, Iowa gubernatorial nominee Deirdre DeGere sees hope and common ground among Iowa voters, including rural voters, which could pave success for Democrats in November. From pushing to provide taxpayer funding to pay for students to attend private schools, to a flat tax on abortion restrictions, DeGere argues Iowa Republican Governor Kim Reynolds has prioritized extreme policies over Iowans while real issues like rural revitalization and access to quality affordable health care and mental health care have been shortchanged. We're seeing minimal results out of the governor's office, DeGere told a gathering of 25 supporters and Linn County Democrats. DeGere stopped at Raygun in Cedar Rapids on Monday night as part of a campaign swing ahead of Iowa Democrat State Convention Saturday in Des Moines. She delivered her report card on Reynolds' performance during her first term. The Des Moines business owner and activist who became the first black candidate to be nominated for statewide office in Iowa with her unsuccessful run for Iowa Secretary of State in 2018 gave Reynolds failing grades on the environment, education, health care, government transparency, housing, women's issues, jobs, and the economy. Are we willing to fight for that common ground? DeGere asked the group of supporters to be real, to talk about the real issues that Iowans are facing, not the ones that people want to use to divide us, like what bathroom somebody goes to, Come on, people need homes. They need a roof over their heads. They need insurance. They need to be able to choose to go to school or a grocery store knowing they can come home safe. This isn't about culture right now. This is about progression as Iowans. This is about fighting for a democracy that we all need to work, but we've got leadership unwilling to use it. DeGere criticized Reynolds' push to use $55 million in state public school funding to provide 10,000 students with scholarships to pay private school expenses. 100% of our students need the undivided attention of our governor in order to improve their opportunity within the education system, DeGere said. DeGere also called out Reynolds for pushing a conservative agenda that supports an unfair 4% flat rate state income tax. She argues benefits the super wealthy and corporations, while rural counties continue to lose population, rural hospitals have closed, and Iowans grapple to access needed mental health care. The vast majority of Iowans are going to get $55 a month 4 years from now, DeGere said of the gradual income tax cuts. Meanwhile, we're sitting on a $1 billion state budget surplus, and we know that money could go to good use today. We can put resources into education. We can put resources into mental health care, as well as workforce and affordable housing. When we look at the legislation and when we look at this cycle from this current governor, we're not seeing that work happen, DeGere continued. Republican Party of Iowa Chairman Jeff Kaufman pushed back at DeGere's assessment. Governor Kim Reynolds has transformed education in Iowa by ensuring students have a 100% in-person learning option, banning mask mandates, and defending parents' rights to be involved in their child's education, Kaufman said in a statement. DeGere was joined by Democratic State Senator Liz Mathis of Hiawatha, who is challenging Republican U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson of Marion in the 1st Congressional District race. Mathis mentioned a recent fundraising call where a woman told her she would not donate to her campaign, but wished her the best of luck. We cannot wish our candidates into office, Mathis said that told the small gathering of Linn County Democrats. We've got to roll up our sleeves. We've got to knock on doors. We've got to get out there and spread the word. And getting a candidate like Deidre DeGere, who is passionate and compassionate, is putting her all into this campaign. That's what's going to get us a win. Continuing with political news, Oxley will not seek recount in Linn County supervisor race. Running Marquardt Banowetz will face off in November. By Gage Miskeman. Democrat Kirsten Running Marquardt of Cedar Rapids and Republican Mark Banowetz of Ely will be vying for the District 1 Linn County supervisor seat in the November 8th general election. Democrat Brianna Oxley, who finished 32 votes behind Running Marquardt in the June 7th primary, told the Gazette she will not be requesting a recount in that contest. After careful consideration and reviewing the canvas of ballots, we've decided not to seek a recount, Oxley said. Running Marquardt won the close three-way Democratic primary for the seat with 1,807 votes to Oxley's 1,775 votes. Former Supervisor James Hauser was third with 1,048 votes. The vote totals were canvassed Tuesday. The winner of the November election will succeed Supervisor Stacy Walker, a Democrat who is not seeking re-election. The newly redrawn District 1 covers southern Cedar Rapids and Linn County, including Ely and Fairfax. Running Marquardt, 44, has represented House District 69 for 13 years in the State House. Banowetz, 64, is a business owner in Ely and a former city council member there. CR Council okays incentives for $6.7 million Kingston project. Proposal entails apartment complex, redevelopment of commercial building. By Sabine Martin. The Cedar Rapids City Council on Tuesday approved city tax incentives for a proposed $6.7 million 3-to-4-story apartment complex in Kingston Village. When completed, it will fill one of the few vacant spots left in the neighborhood redeveloping since the 2008 flood. The entity led by Fred Timko and Gary Rozek will redevelop the south half plot of a property on 4th Avenue Southwest between 2nd Street Southwest and 3rd Street Southwest, and a commercial building, which houses Imon Communications and Kepro's Physical Therapy at 218 4th Avenue Southwest. This will be buildings number 5 and 6 for my development group in Kingston Village, Timko said. With the first and first project underway, there's precious little land left between 5th Avenue and the interstate. The apartment building will have covered parking and walk-up units on the first floor and 20 residential units rented at market rate. The redevelopment of the commercial building just next door to the apartment building will relocate Kepro's Physical Therapy, so Imon Communications, which was acquired by Goldman Sachs Asset Management in February, can expand in the first floor of the building, Timko said. City is providing a temporary reduction on property taxes on 100% of the increment taxes generated by the development, up to a net present value of $750,000 for the redevelopment or 20 consecutive payments. The city gives financial incentives to developers who build properties in areas, including Kingston Village, entered in the Targeted District Reinvestment Economic Development Program. In 2016, the council approved tax breaks for redevelopments in the same area, also led by Timco. As part of the development, Caleb Mason, City Economic Development Manager, said the city will go through the disposition process for a small piece of city-owned land at 202 4th Avenue Southwest. The city will sell the property, acquired after the 2008 flood, at fair market value, and the developer must incorporate flood mitigation measures. Timco made Kingston Village somewhere that people want to be, Councilmember Marty Hager said. He had a vision for the West Side, and he secretly kind of plucked away and redeveloped and redeveloped. Councilmember Scott Overland said the new development is being put to good use with the redevelopment of underused lots. What we have now between that and the First and First redevelopment and also all the public infrastructure is a tremendous combination of downtown living, of which I don't think there are any vacancies these days, as well as commercial developments catering to those living spaces, Overland said. Marion Library opening delayed until fall. New building was expected to open around July 4th, by Gage Miskeman. The new Marion Public Library, which was expected to be open around the 4th of July, is now looking at a September grand opening. Library Director Bill Carroll said the delay comes amid continuing supply chain issues and contractor worker shortages that have been seen around the country since the COVID-19 pandemic began 2 years ago. We're looking at the grand opening sometime shortly after Labor Day, Carroll told the Gazette on Tuesday. The library board has not set a definitive date, but they are expected to do that at their July meeting. The two-floor building is in the 1100 block of 6th Avenue, across the street from the old library, which had been its location since 1996. Marion has doubled its population since the original 24,500 square foot library was built. The new building will be almost twice as big and feature a demonstration kitchen, a recording studio, a green screen room, and gaming spaces. The new facility broke ground in October 2020. The old library was damaged in the August 2020 derecho and never reopened. The city was granted limited occupancy at the end of May. Carroll, director for almost a year, and most of his 25-member staff are now in the new building and are moving in materials and training on new technology. It's been very interesting trying to build relationships with all the team members being at different locations, but now it's interesting watching everyone come back together, too, Carroll said. The Uptown location at 1064 7th Avenue remains open for browsing, pickup, and computer use. I'm feeling confident about the September date, Carroll said. The building is looking good on the inside, and we're making progress every day. Carroll said that along with a long list of minor items that need to be done during construction, two bigger jobs remain, installing railings and the covering for the sinks, a special order item that has been delayed. He said the project still is under its initial $18 million cost. Funding comes from a $3.3 million capital campaign, $5 million in local option sales tax funding, $3 million in property damage insurance and the sale of the current site, $6 million in bonding, and $1 million in tax increment financing. We're doing the best we can to work with the contractors to get open as quickly as possible, and we're going to have an amazing building after Labor Day, Carroll said. Reynolds signs ban on COVID vaccine requirement for students into law, by Aaron Murphy. Colleges, K-12 school districts, and daycare centers in Iowa cannot require students and children to be immunized from COVID-19 under legislation signed into law Tuesday by Governor Kim Reynolds. The bill was among 10 signed into law Tuesday by the governor. Iowa schools, by state law, require 8 types of immunizations by age 5. Immunization from COVID-19 will not be added to that list thanks to House File 2298, which passed the Iowa legislature mostly on party line votes, with Republicans supporting the proposal and Democrats opposing. Reynolds has until a week from Thursday to take action on all bills approved during the recently concluded legislative session. The governor's spokesman said Thursday that roughly a couple dozen bills remain. Among the other bills she signed into law Tuesday were House File 2578, the Health and Human Services Budget Bill, Senate File 529, which is designed to assist victims of fertility fraud. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, June 15th, 2022 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Thomas Tom Perry Miller, 65, of Marion, Iowa, passed away on Thursday, June 9th, 2022 at Unity Point Hospice in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, following a long illness. Per his wishes, he has been cremated and a private service will be held at a later date. Tom was born on October 30, 1956 in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, the son of Leland and Doris Olver Miller. He graduated from Cedar Rapids Jefferson High School in 1975. Tom worked as a cook in various area restaurants, including the Flamingo and Nassau's in Marion. He was a member of the modeling club Alexander Lippisch Fart and Fleas, where he specialized in Army tanks. He was an avid World War II buff and loved to watch war movies and TV shows. Albert Francis Hooper, 91, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, died Monday, June 13, 2022. Visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. on Friday, June 17, 2022, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A memorial service will follow at 11 a.m. on Friday at the funeral home. Burial will take place at Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Albert was born December 29, 1930, in Bridgewater, Massachusetts, the son of Charles and Mildred Leach Hooper. He grew up in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Albert graduated from Bridgewater High School. He was united in marriage to Phyllis Follett Brower on August 28, 1973, in North Glen, Colorado. Albert worked for the Cedar Rapids Police Department and then for Cherry Burrell Evergreen Packaging until his retirement in 1992. He loved all things Boston and Iowa Hawkeyes and was an avid reader. Patricia Pat Ann Schroeder Caton, 88, of Vinton, passed away peacefully on June 13, 2022 at the Western Home Martin Suites Center in Cedar Falls. Service of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, June 17, 2022 at the Trinity Lutheran Church in Vinton, Iowa, with Pastor Stephen Pruce officiating. Visitation will be held from 9 a.m. until time of service at the church. Interment will follow at the Evergreen Cemetery in Vinton. Patricia Ann Schroeder was born in her grandparents' home in Ossian, Iowa, on April 21, 1934. She was the daughter of Elliot and Thema Mosby Schroeder. On October 25, 1951, she married Richard Rick Caton in Postville, Iowa. They had six children. Her mom work life included being a homemaker and raising five children, as Rick's Navy career and employment necessitated the family move multiple times. Her career work life included directing and managing the Senior Dining Center in LaPorte City, Iowa, directing and managing the Senior Community Center in Wilton, Iowa, and cook and kitchen assistant at Vinton Shelsburg Middle School. Her most precious time, however, was time spent with her grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Pat's home was the summer camp for many of her grandchildren through their growing up years. Pat also was an avid lover of the Cardinals and a bona fide chocoholic. James F. Valenta, 78, of Cedar Rapids, died on June 10, 2022, due to dementia. He was married to his wife, Carol, for 56 years, and who was honored to have been by his side throughout. He had a family that he was very proud of. Jim graduated from the University of Iowa with a BBA in 1965 and was president owner of Valenta Plumbing and Heating, Inc., where he worked with his brothers, Tom and Ron. Anyone who knew Jim knew him as a wonderful, funny, generous, and honest man who kept those qualities right to the end. Jim loved playing and watching sports, being in nature, and, of course, fishing. He was grateful not only to have his family, but lifelong close friends, Jim and Judy Hronek, Jan and Bill Kuba, Jean and Mel Yantz, and Steve and Ann Valenta. We are all grateful to have known and loved him. In his honor, we encourage you to think of him as you plant a tree and give to the St. Luke's Hospice, where they were so kind and caring. John Bryant Abadili, 64, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, passed away on Saturday, June 11, 2022, at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. A celebration of life gathering will be held from 3 to 8 p.m. on Friday, June 17, 2022, at Palisades Kepler State Park Lodge, 700 Kepler Drive, Mount Vernon, Iowa, 52314. Casual dress is encouraged. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service assisted the family. John was born May 25, 1958, in Cedar Rapids, the son of Kenneth and Joyce Harris Abadili. He graduated from Linmar High School in 1976. John was an operations superintendent who worked for CEI Equipment and KT Pacer for 25 years. John was a lifelong outdoorsman who loved to go deer and pheasant hunting, fishing, and mushrooming. He was a beautiful artist, skilled in textured oil paintings, and had a love of rock and roll music. Nobody had a kinder heart than John. His legacy of compassion and kindness lives on as John gifted his eyes to two individuals through the Iowa Donor Network. Memorials may be directed to the family. Beverly Yvonne Pitcher, 83, of Lamont, Iowa, formerly of Oroville, California, died on Monday, June 13, 2022, at her daughter's home due to complications from post-polio syndrome. Survivors include her daughter, Catherine Mark Pitcher Adams of Lamont, Iowa, a sister, Jan Hofer of Oroville, California, two brothers, Jack Sherry Henderson of Red Bluff, California, and Jim Suze Henderson of Oroville, and many nieces and nephews. Online condolences may be sent to leonard-mullerfh.com. Funeral service, 11 a.m., Saturday, June 18, 2022, at Community Bible Church in Strawberry Point, Iowa, with Pastor Bruce Klett officiating. Visitation, 9 to 11 a.m., Saturday, June 18, 2022, at Community Bible Church in Strawberry Point. Interment at a later date in Oroville, California. Timothy A. Miller, 81, of Lisbon, Iowa, was called to heaven on Sunday, June 12, 2022, at his residence in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be held from 3 to 6 p.m. on Friday, June 17th at Stuart Baxter Funeral Home and Memorial Services in Mount Vernon. Following the visitation, there will be a service. Burial will take place at a later date. Survivors include his wife, Jo Diane, children, Colleen Miller of Cedar Rapids, Christina Miller of Las Vegas, Nevada, Timothy Jr., Jamie of Colfax, Wisconsin, and Joseph, Jill, of Lisbon, three grandchildren, a sister, two nephews, and numerous other relatives and friends. Please share your support and memories with Tim's family on his tribute wall at stuartbaxter.com under obituaries. Richard Rick Lewis Hayes, 73, of Hiawatha, died Tuesday, June 14, 2022, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy, following a short but courageous battle with cancer. Funeral Mass, 11 a.m. Friday, St. Patrick Catholic Church, by the Reverend Greg Ball. Private family burial, Mount Calvary Cemetery. Rick was born on June 30, 1948, in Cedar Rapids, son of Lewis and Elizabeth Wathier Hayes. He attended St. Patrick Grade School, graduated in 1967 from LaSalle High School, and received an associate's degree from Upper Iowa University Fayette. On February 27, 1981, Rick married Rosemary Fagan at St. Patrick Catholic Church. He had a long-standing career in sales, and after retirement, he enjoyed working at the Stony Point YMCA. Rick excelled in football, basketball, and baseball in high school, and later in life, he played 14- and 16-inch softball for years. He was inducted into the LaSalle High School and the Cedar Rapids Softball Hall of Fame. Rick attended all of his kids' and grandkids' activities and rarely missed a day of working out at the gym. During his last days, Rick reminded his family that he led a very wonderful life full of love and lasting memories, and for them to continue on his legacy. He never met a stranger or a Hallmark movie he didn't like, and was a wonderful person who was loved by all and will be greatly missed. Instead of flowers, memorials may be directed to St. Patrick Catholic Church. Lewis A. Thurston, 75, of Magnolia, Texas, passed away on February 16, 2022. Graveside service, 10 a.m., Friday, June 17, 2022, at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is assisting the family. Lewis was born on July 30, 1946, at Mercy Hospital in Cedar Rapids. He was the son of Charles A. Jr. and Velma A. Walker Thurston. Lewis joined the U.S. Navy on his 17th birthday, July 30, 1963. He was sworn in at Des Moines, Iowa, and went to boot camp at the Naval Training Station in San Diego, California. Lewis' first tour of duty was aboard the USS Coral Sea. The Coral Sea's home port was San Francisco, California. After he was assigned to the Coral Sea, he was flown by mail plane and landed aboard the aircraft carrier due to the fact that it was back in San Francisco. He served in the South China Sea for 331 days from October 1964 to September 1965. Lewis continued to serve in the U.S. Navy until his honorable discharge in March of 1968. Lewis enjoyed woodworking and owned a cabinet shop. He also owned a racetrack. His hobbies were fishing and hunting. He will be greatly missed. That concludes today's obituaries. We'll now move on to the editorial page and today's letters to the editor. The first one is from Ann Treanor of Cedar Rapids. The headline reads, Senators claim AR-15s are needed for varmints. I just heard Senator John Thune of South Dakota and Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana justify the continued sale of military-style weapons like AR-15s in order to keep down the varmint population. Query, is there not an inherent danger in two political varmints legitimizing the blowing away of other varmints by AR-15s? Again, that was from Ann Treanor of Cedar Rapids. The next letter is from Maxine Brosh of Cedar Rapids. I-380 in Cedar Rapids in need of beautification. I live along Interstate 380 in Cedar Rapids. On occasion, I drive on Highway 100 and see that there were many beautiful trees planted this spring, which is so great to see. However, the trees along I-380 are dead, dying, or broken. Fences are also broken. Many junk trees and weeds have grown along the fences. In short, it's an eyesore and a shame that the many people who travel this very important part of the Avenue of the Saints have this visual of our beautiful city. The derecho was definitely a driving factor in the way it looks, but can't be blamed for all of it. It needed to be rejuvenated long before that. Something needs to happen, and happen soon, to improve the looks of I-380 through Cedar Rapids. Let's make it happen. Again, that is from Maxine Brash of Cedar Rapids. Next is a guest column from Mac Sinovic, who is the executive director of Progress Iowa, a progressive advocacy organization. The title is Iowa GOP Puts Politics Over People. No matter what we look like or where we live, Iowans want similar things. We want to make a good living, care for our families, and feel safe and connected to our communities. But thanks to the policies of Iowa Republicans, that hasn't been easy. The things that cost and matter the most, a roof over our heads, child care for our kids, health care for our families, have long been put out of reach so wealthy corporations and billionaires can pay us less than they owe and rake in record profits. And once again, Governor Kim Reynolds and the Republican-led legislature have failed Iowans. As we watch the rest of America get back to work and begin to thrive, Reynolds and the Republicans spent the 2022 legislative session attacking working families, bullying kids, and targeting our public schools. The unfair flat tax system passed this year will provide massive tax breaks for corporations and the ultra-wealthy. Lawmakers will be forced to choose between severe reductions in services or a massive increase in other taxes or fees. As if these massive gifts to wealthy corporations and the rich weren't enough to hurt working families and the services we rely on, Corporate Kim pushed for the cuts to earned unemployment benefits. These cuts are sure to force Iowa workers into jobs that don't pay enough to take care of our families, keep wages low, and make Iowa a more unwelcoming state. The legislature put a target on the backs of our teachers, driving hundreds of them out of our schools, bullied already marginalized transgender kids out of playing sports with their friends, and forced inadequate funding increase far below inflation on our state's public education system, which will only worsen Iowa's teacher shortage. The GOP's bill allowing child care workers to care for more 2- and 3-year-olds and allowing 16- and 17-year-olds to work unsupervised in child care centers will make kids less safe and put more stress on an already exhausted and underpaid workforce. Republican lawmakers sent a clear message during the legislative session: politics matter more than people. While Iowa Democrats worked tirelessly to pass meaningful legislation that strengthens our public schools, puts more money in the pockets of Iowans, and addresses critical needs, Iowa Republicans doubled down on the policies that created the Reynolds workforce crisis. However, we can't discount the few wins we saw this year. Lawmakers were able to pass legislation that will expand first responder access to naloxone for drug overdoses, make more students eligible for college and job training scholarships, and will exempt diapers and feminine hygiene products from sales tax. We're also happy to see that the governor's plan to provide public school dollars for private school vouchers failed to pass. We need leaders who reward work, not wealth. Iowans deserve a governor and legislature that prioritize people over politics. We must stand up and call on our elected officials to pass legislation that will support public schools and make Iowa a place people want to live, work, and raise a family. And that, again, is from Matt Sinovic, who is the executive director of Progress Iowa. Now we'll move on to local sports news. Cascade ascends to third in Class 2A poll. Cougars have won 4 in a row and lead River Valley Conference North Division. By K.J. Pilcher. Cascade rose to the challenge of a tough week. The Cougars have reaped the rewards of a four-game win streak, ascending the Class 2A state rankings. After making its debut last week, Cascade jumped to third in the Iowa High School Baseball Coaches Association poll Monday. The Cougars won their fourth straight game Monday, beating previously ranked Anamosa 6-0. "We went through a gambit of teams," Cascade coach Rome Hummel said after a 6-3 home victory over fifth-ranked rival Dyersville Beckman on Friday. "We didn't play as well as we're capable of, and then I felt like last Tuesday we had a really good batting practice. We kind of changed some things and talked to them about approach. I thought it was good and carried over." The Cougars have faced current top 10 teams, Beckman and Mid-Prairie, Anamosa twice, preseason number 2 Jessup, and Iowa City Regina in the last six games. They finished the stretch 4-2 after losing the first two games and avenging the loss to the Blue Raiders. Cascade is 10-2 overall, 7-1 to lead the River Valley Conference North Division. "We figured out our mistakes," Cascade's Mason Otting said. "We fixed them and played well." Ty Frasher leads the Cougars' offense with 16 hits, 12 RBIs, and a .471 batting average. Cade Roush has 12 hits, 10 RBIs, and hits at a .333 clip. The Cougars own three shutouts and an impressive 1.36 team earned run average. Freshman Cooper Hummel leads the way with a 4-0 mark. He's tallied 33 strikeouts in 18 and two-thirds innings pitched and owns a 1.50 ERA. Jack Carr also has four wins with a .49 ERA, fanning 28 in as many innings. The top-ranked teams are Johnston, 4A, Grinnell, 3A, Van Meter, 2A, and Remsen St. Mary's in 1A. Three Mississippi Valley Conference teams and three from the WAMAC Conference are in the top 10 of 3A. Cedar Rapids Xavier is third, joined by number 4 Dubuque Wallard and number 5 Western Dubuque from the MVC. The WAMAC trio consists of 7th-ranked Clear Creek Amana, number 8 Independence, and number 9 Marion, the defending 3A state champion. Iowa City High and Cedar Rapids Prairie remained in the top 10 of 4A. The Little Hawks are 6th, while Prairie is 9th. In 1A, Lansing Key is up one spot to 4th, Northlynn dropped two spots to 5th, and Lisbon remains at number 6. Northlynn hosts Lisbon on Thursday in Troy Mills. Sigourney moved up to 9th. Washington beats Wallert, snaps 88-game losing streak. Dubuque. Cedar Rapids Washington snapped an 88-game softball losing streak Tuesday, defeating Dubuque Wallert 9-5 in the first game of a Mississippi Valley Conference doubleheader. Washington's previous win was June 15, 2019, a 4-3 triumph over Crestwood. The Warriors lost their last 17 games of that season, then went 0-16 in 2020 and 0-40 last year. The Warriors started 0-15 this summer before breaking through Tuesday. That's by Jeff Linder of the Gazette. Here are some sports briefs from the first page of the sports section under the headline Sideline. Prep soccer. Xavier duo earns All-State honors. Cedar Rapids Xavier had a pair of Class 2A first-team All-Staters in defender Eden Campbell and midfielder Mary Kate Mater. The Iowa High School Soccer Coaches Association released its 2022 All-State girls and boys soccer teams Monday night. Mount Vernon's Maya Bentley also is on the 2A first team. Other Gazette area first-teamers are Linmar midfielder Sophia Bush in 3A and Centerpoint Urbana defender Madison Daly in 1A. Norwalk senior forward Jocelyn Bice was named Miss Soccer. Des Moines Roosevelt senior defender Ryan Wang was named Mr. Soccer. Gazette area first-team All-Staters are Marion forward Jackson Kirsch in Class 2A and Vinton-Shelsburg midfielder Gunnar Moen, West Liberty forward Josiah Galvin, North Fayette Valley midfielder Andre Fuentes, and West Branch forward Peyton Miller in 1A. Men's basketball. UI signed 6'4 guard from Turkey. The UNI men's basketball team announced Tuesday the signing of Ege Peksari, a native of Izmir, Turkey. The 6'4 guard played for the Gemlik Basketball Club in the Turkish Basketball League while also playing on Turkey's U-20 national team. "We are very excited to add Ege to our program today," UNI men's basketball coach Ben Jacobson said in a news release. "He is a big guard with great instincts and a highly competitive spirit." Mental health. Espe Pfeiffer, director of Iowa program. Patricia Espe Pfeiffer has been named to the position of director of sports psychology and student-athlete mental health services for University of Iowa Athletics. Espe Pfeiffer joins the UI athletic staff after serving as a clinical professor and neuropsychologist with the UIHC Department of Psychiatry since 2004. S.B. Pfeiffer is a faculty member and provider within the UIHC Stead Family Children's Hospital and has served as Director of Child Psychology and Pediatric Neuropsychology Services with Child Psychiatry. Adding this position strengthens our commitment to student-athlete mental health, along with the additional steps we have taken to add staff to address the needs of this important topic and supporting our student-athletes, Iowa AD Gary Barta said in a news release. Now some high school wrestling news. State duels heading to Extreme Arena. IHSAA sets three-year agreement, date set after inaugural IGHSAU tournament. By KJ Pilcher. The Iowa High School Athletic Association has found a new home for its state duels wrestling tournament. The move comes after a decision in April to move the event to the first Saturday in February, beginning in the 2022-23 season. The IHSAA Board of Control approved a three-year agreement with Extreme Arena in Coralville to host the state duels tournament, according to a news release Tuesday. The competition will follow the inaugural Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union-sanctioned state wrestling tournament set for February 2nd to 3rd at the venue. We're thrilled to take our state dual team tournament to Extreme Arena, which will provide a world-class wrestling venue and staff for our student athletes, IHSAA Executive Director Tom Keating said in a news release. Scheduling alongside the new girls tournament will benefit our participating schools, officials, and spectators. The tournament returns to Eastern Iowa after 11 seasons at Wells Fargo Arena in Des Moines, taking place the day before the traditional state tournament. With the elimination of sectional weekend, the open weekend allowed the date and location to be changed. Continuing with high school sports, IHSAA to retake full control of postseason bracket. Coaches previously determined official pairings via seating meetings. By Jeff Johnson. No more pods, no more coaches seating meetings. The Iowa High School Athletic Association announced Tuesday it will again take over full responsibilities for postseason district, sub-state, and state tournament pairings in boys basketball. The IHSAA Board of Control approved the change, which was recommended by its Basketball Advisory Committee. We appreciate the Advisory Committee and leadership from the Iowa Basketball Coaches Association being proactive with this adjustment, said IHSAA Assistant Director Todd Tharp. Pushing back the release dates will allow us to gather as much information as possible from regular season games and complete improved postseason assignments. In recent seasons, the IHSAA released postseason pods or groupings in each class in January. Postseason brackets were released in late January, determined by vote of coaches in the district or substate who seeded each team. The same process was used in determining state tournament brackets. The IHSAA retaking full control moves back the release of postseason brackets to early and mid-February, according to class. That theoretically allows more time to figure out the top teams in an area, with brackets constructed accordingly, all in hopes of getting the best teams to the state tournament. As always, however, geography will play a huge part in the brackets. I love that they did this, said Belle Plaine coach Justin Northrup. The meetings were always contentious. We would always go north for the most part for district and be on an island with no one there to help us. We want to be responsive to our advisory committee and head coaches with their concerns regarding assignments and seating meetings, Tharp said. And now some brief business news. CR Costume Shop scales down rented costumes. The business aims to sell some 6,000 of its rental costumes. By Sabine Martin. After collecting and sewing a collection of about 6,000 rental costumes, balloons, etc., and the Costume Emporium in downtown Cedar Rapids, is downsizing its costume rental business. Jacob and Kimberly Cowger, owners of the Costume and Balloon Shop at 420 2nd Avenue Southeast, are selling off their curated costume stock. The sale started Monday. It's tough to see them go. I worked very hard to build this up and have a quality costume shop, he said. A lot of these are all handmade costumes. Jacob said the downsizing comes after unsuccessful efforts in finding adequate staff to repair and re-sew the intricate costumes. The business opened downtown as a balloon shop in 2004. It lost hundreds of its costumes in the 2008 flood, but reopened following the flood. We're still hoping to keep a packaged costumes and makeup and wigs and accessories, but the more elaborate and higher-priced costumes are going to go, he said. It will take a little bit to get rid of them all unless someone comes in and takes racks and racks of them, which I have seen happen. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, June 15th, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.